Stan, I'm delighted that you are back with us, so welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to be here. We'll have a bit of fun tonight with those questions, I'm sure.
I'm sure we will. Stan, you told us last week that part of what you did when you were working for these people is that you were working on the Illuminati, basically UFO technology.
Right.
I wanted to dive into that a little bit, and let me just start by asking up front, do they have what we call UFOs?
Yes. Several types.
Okay. And how long have they had these?
Good question. I think probably the ones that we've made, your man has made, from about the mid-50s, early 50s perhaps. Before that, I don't think we had them. Maybe the Germans might have, but we didn't at that time.
Mm-hmm. Now, this Illuminati, this bunch is not, they are not strictly American.
No, after World War II, the Illuminist group that formed included East and West Germans, Norwegians, Russians, Americans, Canadians, Australians. I'm not sure whether New Zealand was involved in it. It's possible. Just trying to think who else. Anyway, a number of the major nations in the Allies and in the Allied occupied territories after World War II were involved in this. And basically, it was an infrastructure that was not political. These Illuminists were and are bankers, international bankers, big enough to loan money to countries for whatever needs they had, usually for war. Also, engineers, scientists, physicists, newspapermen, and newspapers. All these things that they needed to kind of aim for a global government and convince the people of it in the times to come, which we're in now.
Okay, so, I mean, this is not something that just forms out of thin air. There had to be an organizer, an organizing force behind it. Who was the organizing force behind it?
That's kind of hard to say. Anyone who studied the history of the Illuminati found that Adam Weishaupt in 1776, I think it was, in Bavaria, became a member of the Freemasons and managed to siphon off the cream of the crop of the Freemasons there in Bavaria to form a secret society within a secret society. And their objective was to get rid of the king of Bavaria and start a global movement from there, and they would pass it through the Masonic societies. However, the king of Bavaria found out about it and imprisoned or killed a lot of them, the conspirators, and people thought at that time the Illuminati went to ground. However, evidence in our country at the time of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, our forefathers did make mention in various historic documents that they were aware of an invisible hand working our economy here in the United States, the fledgling United States at that time. So somewhere back in there, this group formed kind of out of the ashes of the failed Weishaupt attempt in Bavaria.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these people are, I mean, they come and go. I mean, families have children, and some go into the Illuminist movement. Others are not qualified and aren't inducted. But their whole objective has been to recruit people like in the movie Atlas Shrugged with John Galt, was to recruit people who are producers, who see the world's problems and the solution to them being a global one, perhaps the way Ayn Rand's book, the Atlas Shrugged, solved a problem with John Galt is not the way the Illuminists of today are doing it, but they're doing close to that, in that they've sequestered themselves away from modern man, in essence, observing man from their own secret places, whether they be underground or wherever, to try to form this new world government through the process I talked about last time, which was deception. because they knew that negotiation through United Nations type organizations and forced world government like Hitler tried, neither one of them would work in the long term. So this last thing, this deception, was to fool everyone into accepting a world order that is apparently a non-human origin, and that they would accept it and live under it long enough to realize that it worked better than having war. So their objectives really in the beginning were pure and let's stop war, and then it rapidly grew into, well, we're so much smarter than everybody else and we're got so much power, they're going to do it the way we're talking about because that's what these little people need. That's when the Illuminati kind of took a wrong turn. And
okay, so we have this situation now in our country, and it exists in other countries, where all the politicians talk about how bad war is, and how they want peace, and yet wars are being churned out as if they're coming off of a factory assembly line. And I'm almost 59 years old, and I was born just after the end of hostilities in Korea, and grew up with the Cold War and very near hostilities. Well, there were some skirmishes with Cuba, and then all of that CIA war down in South America and Vietnam. And, the list just keeps rolling. It just keeps going. And now, of course, America itself has been identified as by its government as a battlefield. And so I guess it's coming to our front door. But here's the question. After having explained that, is the Illuminati behind that? I mean, if what they wanted was to get people to realize that their way of government brings peace and it's better than war, then who's behind churning out all these wars?
Well, the Illuminist, the way they've attacked the problem is that they've been pitting nation against nation, smaller ones in the beginning, to form a synthesis after the war was over of one nation out of two. And now we've come to the point where we've got maybe three major superpowers on the planet that need to be unified. The smaller countries ally themselves with one of these three, or maybe two of them in some cases. The Illuminists have used war to unify, believe it or not, unify cultures and technologies. Now we're at a point where they have a situation where they can't really afford a global war, but skirmishes, yes. America, because of our nature here, Americans' nature, we ask why. We challenge things where other populations aren't quite as vocal and challenging as we are to our governments and why they're doing things. The information that you and I are sharing here has been shared in many ways about the Illuminati and their plan by many sources in the Western world, and particularly here in America and American satellite countries or allied countries like Australia and New Zealand. Because of this, the plan that they had is kind of leaking out into the open, and I think what they're doing is allowing this to happen. Now, they wouldn't have wanted it, but it is happening, and they're allowing it to happen quietly, without objection from them, thinking that the people who believe and understand what they're doing from what's being told here, and places like what we're doing now, that people that understand what's happening will join them and will assist them rather than resist them. This is, I'm pretty sure, why they're allowing these things to happen. But America itself, the American people, present a thorn in their side because we will object, and we do object to being enslaved. Therefore, America had to be taken down to where it wasn't the super cop, the super state that has presided over the world since the end of World War II. To do that, the economy has to be wrecked, the grassroots resistance has to be weakened, and certainly the economy will do that, breaking the economy, and perhaps producing martial law, certainly by throwing patents that we have here over to the Chinese and Asian to Europe, which rapes us of a productivity, and eventually, which is now coming, our productivity is so low that we're becoming a third world country very shortly, or, you know, like the third world countries that are existing now. This is why they're allowing the skirmishes, is because in that chaos, people will panic, people will cry out for peace, and in addition to the climatic changes, the geophysical changes which are underway now with earthquakes, people will feel so threatened that they will clamor for this new world order without the support of the American media, private media, or grassroots media like we are here. And therefore, they hope to achieve this deception to set up the world government without the thorn in the side, which is us.
Okay, so what role do the UFO craft play in all of this?
A very big role. There are two sources of these UFO craft. One is man-made, and the other is made by beings that are super beings compared to us. Now, I didn't choose the word alien because I think these beings were here before mankind was on the Earth, visiting from, or doing whatever they were doing, from a parallel universe concentric to our own. I get this from reading old records, Hebrew and some Chaldean Aramaic records, and translated Babylonian clay tablets. They talk about the first and second and third heavens, like levels to thing, and in Hebrew about Tahom, the lower depths inside a bottomless pit, which is the inside of a ball like the Earth, a hollow ball at that point. So all these beings I'm talking about that have those kind of craft have been with us since before the Garden of Eden time. So they're not really alien. They're only extraterrestrial because they've come from a parallel universe and ported, gated into our existence for a particular purpose, a rebellion in essence. So their craft and our craft are different. Our craft are anti-gravity craft, plasma craft. There's a number of types of craft we've made. They were saucer-shaped and long cylindrical and triangular. But they are not as advanced as these beings that have been here before us. Understand, they've been here thousands of years before us. And the technology they have is even older than that. So, I mean, to try to compete with them is really impossible, not on an equal footing. So people think they can do this are kind of deluding themselves. Without the help of where they came from the good guys in the parallel universe where they've been cast out, without that help, our technology, as best we can do, won't even dent them. I mean, it's just, we're helpless. So without outside help, we're not going to beat them.
Our craft, basically, the picture I'm getting from what you're describing is that our UFOs, our anti-gravity craft, compared to their craft, would be something like a bi-wing airplane trying to take on a modern fighter jet, a Raptor.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's an airborne thing. I was thinking more like Da Vinci's flying kite man compared to this, because we're really primitive. I mean, molecular physics that they've got, they can polarize a living body and pass it through a solid wall, polarizing both of them to match and then moving through the grid of atoms that's there. I mean, we can conceptually understand that, but technologically we can't duplicate, as far as I know. That kind of stuff, I mean, how do you protect yourself if they can come in through your wall and paralyze you at night and take you out and do whatever they're going to do and put you back? Kind of hard. And how do you hide secrets from them when they can eavesdrop anywhere on the planet without planting bugs? Just modifying a field. I mean.
Okay. Have you ever seen any of our craft, our anti-gravity?
I've seen them. I assume they're ours, here in Colorado Springs during the daytime a couple times up over NORAD. They were very fast, silver kind of spherical devices moving very rapidly, bobbing in and out of the clouds, and where they went after that, I don't know. I've seen photos of our assembly areas elsewhere, probably in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia at the time, about 120 miles into the desert outside Riyadh, near Jabal Tuwaik. But, you know, those were the 30-foot diameter craft, and I was able to see the main drive coils being assembled, the arch loops around the coil. And I even have some drawings I made of that.
All right. Tell you what, go ahead and get your drawings ready to go, and we have to step away for a break. And
all right.
Come from this break, we'll take a look at those. We'll be back, folks.
Hi, this is Ed DeGangi from Western Connecticut, and you're listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Stan Deo. Stan, we were talking about this bunch of UFOs or flying saucers or whatever, anti-gravity craft, in the possession of the Illuminati. And I had asked you if you had ever seen these craft. You said that you have seen the propulsion system being put together. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, yes. There were men working on it. It was about a 30-foot diameter craft, and they were in a typical kind of large corrugated metal building, and I assume that was at the Riyadh facility, or outside there at Jabal Tuwaik. And there were, oh gosh, I guess four or five craft being assembled there. And the closest one, I was shown a photograph of a cross-section of the main drive coil. Coils. Mm-hmm. There are two of them, and the construction before they put the lid on them. I was just trying to find. I did some drawings of that, but I haven't been able to quite find them.
That's okay. If you find them as we go along, just let me know you're about to put them up. And
well, I'll show you here with one I've got from an animation that I did based on the same thing. Just
okay.
Let me. I'm going to just switch over here for a second. Okay, hopefully that's there, is it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, well, where my cursor is over here on the upper right-hand side of the screen, in the assembly area, these wires that you see going across here actually were bundled up and taped or bound in some manner and formed an archway there so you could actually walk into that area. And there were two coils, flat coils on either side of this, big flat coils that were bent over, you know, formed around it. Which were quite critical to the operation of the field once it got established, because on the assembly room floor there, they marked those flat side coils with an A and a B, showing that this side A has to face into the center and this one side B has to face in the center. If you reversed it and by accident and assembled the craft and then turned on the field, it would generate a field that would suddenly collapse on itself and vaporize the craft and a lot of area around it suddenly. So this is the basic drive coil. It's a hollow coil, as you can see up here, that's hollow inside. And it's a square section coil made from a Mu metal type thing, which is basically a metal that's a very good inductor for a core. And the best that we have around, I suppose, would be.
Okay, so now this this coil would be that you've just showed us. This coil would be what, like 30 feet in diameter?
That'd be slightly less than that. The craft that was going, or the cap going on it, was about 30 feet in diameter. It's about a one or two man craft. They had a lot of trouble with the first ones that we built. I mean, because you're doing it kind of without the help of the original designers. What happened, like in California or say in Arizona, when they were going from there on a test flight over toward Florida, they'd rev up the field, which alters the rate of time passage inside the field. And they would aim, you know, or navigate to go to Florida, push the go button, whew, and then turn off the field or slow it down, in other words, so that they could stop over Florida and find out they'd overshot and were clear in the middle of the Atlantic. because of the time differential. Your clocks run differently, your standard clocks on board the craft. So they had to compensate for that, and that was done fairly simply. But little problems like that did occur. And a number of other ones where when you leave the craft, you're charged up. I mean, your whole body is charged, and so you want to discharge yourself before you get too far from the craft. Otherwise, big sparks will jump out and electrocute you and possibly burn you up just from the energy stored in you while you're in the craft. Those are not, you know, major hassles, but they are indeed considerations that the guys had to face. Sorry about that.
Okay, so what effect does that have on, like, human DNA?
Good question, actually. I don't know. It certainly changes the spin rate of your atoms. That's how it alters the time, because time is just comparing distances, really, expansion, contraction, size of atoms and subatomic particles. When you're in the field, you're going to age, but you'll either slowly age compared to your twin outside or rapidly age compared to that same twin, depending upon whether it's higher density or lower density to the energy outside the ship. Mm-hmm. A case in point, there was a sergeant in South America at night guarding an Air Force base, and I can't remember whether it was Brazil or where, but it's a fairly well-known case. And he and his men saw a flying saucer, bright light, silver, you know, or like a glowing disc, land off the Air Force base out into the scrub. So they all went out to look for it at night, and the sergeant went out his way and sent his men this way and that way. The men all came back after about, 30 minutes, and the sergeant wasn't with them. So they started looking for the sergeant. Eventually, he stumbled out from the scrub and said, "Ah, muchachos," and he's so glad to see them, and he has a 5-day growth of beard all of a sudden, and he's absolutely pale. When they talked to him, what happened was he saw the craft. He came up close to it, and as he started to walk into the field, of course, time sped up for him, and he spent 5 days in that field, and it was only 15 minutes that he'd been missing outside the field. So you can see how it does play things with your body, and if it makes you age like that, it may only make you age faster and not alter your DNA. I mean, he looked like the same guy, except just 5 days older. There have been a number.
Okay, so how do they discharge themselves when they get out of this craft? How do they discharge this built-up energy that has been stored in their bodies from being on the craft?
Well, from the humans that are doing it, rather than the ones that have got the advanced technology, they wore metallic body suits so that they could, you know, sharp edges on it, so you could discharge out into the atmosphere. You walk slowly out of the field. You don't do anything in a hurry, and you discharge as you leave the field. But it might take several hours of your time, just a few seconds to the observer. But that was the initial way to do it, was to discharge with fine points on a metallic conductor so that none of it went through your body but went through the conductive skin you had, the metallic suit.
You know, that sounds very much like what you just described, sounds very much like the testimony of, I think his name is Lonnie Zamora.
Don't know that.
New Mexico, I believe it is. Maybe not. Might be Nevada. Anyway, he was a state policeman, and years ago a craft landed, and he saw it, and I'm pretty sure this is Zamora's testimony. I might have this mixed up with somebody else. Anyway, there was a being in a silvery metallic looking suit that was exiting the craft. So that could be, instead of extraterrestrial, one of these craft that you're talking about, one of the Illuminati craft.
Could be. Nowadays, it's kind of hard to separate the two. In the late 70s, the underground bases that the humans had shared with, many of them anyway, with the super beings, the fallen ones from the parallel universe, those bases were taken over by the super beings. They kicked the humans out of most of them, if not all of them. I'm not privy to the details after that. I had left the organization by the time this happened, but I knew it was coming because my control, Sir John Williams, told me that they were moving in on us at that time. They had helped us since the 50s with giving us technology in exchange for various favors that we'd let them use livestock and do DNA experiments on humans and that sort of stuff. Limited, but they overstepped what they agreed to do anyway from the beginning. Now, we had built for them, humans had built for them, these underground facilities with manufacturing technologies, and they helped us to use very advanced technologies that aren't available in the open world today. Once we had developed the infrastructure for them to manufacture their own weapons and equipment that they needed to fight their battle with where they came from, coming down here to get after them, they didn't need us anymore, so they kicked us out. And that occurred in the late 70s. After that time, I don't know that there were many of our craft seen. Some of them, some of the technology is flying around now, but I don't know that we have quite the rule of the skies that we had while they were helping us.
Mm. All right. Now, that brings up something, because you're talking about these super beings being from another dimension, and you've referred to them as the fallen ones. I think we can also, we could shorthand it all by saying they're the bad guys, right?
Absolutely. They were.
Okay, but you also said in this other dimension, there are some white hats. There are some good guys. And that they are coming here to do battle. You just referred to that.
Yes.
Last year, you were on a radio show, and you were being interviewed, and you made reference to something about upper levels in the Pentagon whispering about the Anunnaki are coming back. What's with that?
Well, they were saying it's the return of the Sumerian gods, and I got that from talking to Linda Moltenhau, who was in the Pentagon and heard it herself. We talked by phone when I was in Australia, and she explained to me that they were expecting the return of the Sumerian gods, which, I mean, you could call them the Anunnaki or whatever, but they were in the records of the Sumerians. And these gods, little g gods, were beings with superpowers that were magic to the people at the time, so they qualified as gods. And it wasn't just in Sumeria. I mean, the Japanese records show it, the Indian, Asian Indian records show it, the Chinese records show it, the Japanese records show it, and South American. So, These beings are bad dudes. They really have rebelled against the established order in the heavens under what we would call God today, or the Elohim. And they are expecting to be shot down, or put in jail, or disappeared, or whatever, by the original creator that they've rebelled against. We're kind of fodder in this fight. And,
okay, so then using then Hebrew, because what you're describing is basically the same story as what we're getting out of the Bible, although it's also very similar in the Sumerian texts, but using the Hebrew, then El is on his way back, and he's ticked.
Yeah. He's coming back as El Shaddai, the strong one.
Okay, so he's El's on his way back. He's ticked, and the Pentagon is aware of it. That's your information. The Pentagon is aware of this.
Well, they're aware of the fallen ones coming here in greater numbers than they were. I don't know where they were, still in the heavens, the parallel universe or elsewhere. But what they were talking about was the increasing numbers of the bad guys. So I just want to make that clear.
Do you think that might have something to do with the space-based space surveillance system? They began launching in right at the end of 2010, and it's supposed to be 10 super satellites. They are optical and other remote sensing capabilities, but optical telescopes, and they're not looking at Earth. They're looking into deep space, and it's a space-based space surveillance system. the publication that I read said that their purpose is to identify and track deep space forces for both offensive and defensive purposes. We have to take a break. I'll get your comment on that when we come back.
All right.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Stan Deo. And Stan, as we went away for break, I brought up the space-based space surveillance system. Now, this is a real, honest-to-God system that has it was proposed by the Air Force. It has been built. It is still being built, and more of them being deployed, some of them already up there. And their purpose is to look out into space, not looking at Earth. And according to the article that was written about it, quoting from Air Force articles, that its purpose is to look into deep space in order to identify and track deep space forces. I would like to know who the heck is in deep space. Who are they looking for?
Well, these fallen ones don't have to stay around Earth. I mean, they've got the technology to fly a lot of other places. And there may be even other types of beings here other than the fallen ones in nearby neighborhoods, you know, astronomically speaking. It's interesting, on our website at standeo.com, in the video of the week, the second one is called U.S. Military Officially Preparing for a False Flag Alien Invasion. And it's an interview done all out of the country with one or two people out of our Department of Defense actually talking about what you're talking about, preparing to detect deep space alien invasion and to prepare for such an invasion as best we can, how we would do it. That in itself, for a DOD person to come out with name and everything and say these kind of things, to me is saying that they're intentionally trying to turn our attention to the fact that aliens may be here, you know. Of course they are, but they're the super beings, the fallen ones. But yet they're preparing people for an announcement, official announcement, that they are here. That's all I see in these kind of statements being released. We'll check the heavens and see. You know, we haven't seen any yet, guys. We haven't really lied to you. That's what I see when I look at that kind of evidence and that system being set up.
Well, yeah, I don't disagree with you, but I would say what a complete waste of energy and money. The government doesn't have to pat me on the head and say, yes, there are doorknobs. I've seen them. People all over the world have seen, beings that are not from this planet. We don't have to be patted on the head and told they're here. We know that they are here and we know that the government is systematically lying about it. Why they do that is a bit of a mystery, but, telling me that dogs exist, okay, well, I appreciate that information. You know, I've seen dogs all my life, but okay, you know.
Well, this is primitive. I mean, these detection methods are primitive based on what I know about these beings. I mean, their technology is way in advance of ours. At the push of a button or less, even a thought, they could probably disappear all those deep space probes and satellites and disable, you know, electronics with an EMP type thing or even more exotic. So what they're doing is making people aware of, well, we've used our best technology, you know, to detect if they're there or if they're coming in so that we can prepare a defense. We really don't know anything about them, you see. And this is all smoke and mirrors, the Wizard of Oz type stuff.
Yeah, it's just a game.
It is. It is.
Yeah. Okay, so where do the Sumerian gods fit into this? The Sumerians called them gods. They were quite obviously human-like in many ways, including base emotions. These Sumerian gods, man, they were jealous. They were greedy. They were warlike. Loved incest. Rape was not beyond them. And you know, they had all of the baser emotions and instincts that we see in the dark underside of our race, which has led many theologians to say that it. All they did when they talked about their gods, it was the personification of the baser elements of being human. Maybe not. Maybe we are created in their likeness, or maybe, you know, their creator is our creator, and thus the similarities. But here's the deal. Are they the good guys? Are they the bad guys?
They're the bad guys, and I disagree with the historians trying to say that that was just the personification of these human traits, because the same type of pantheon of gods, fighting, warring, jealousy, that, you know, the bad stuff, is recorded in cultures that are vastly separated, you know, by sea and land from the Middle East, from the Sumerian area. You know, the Indian gods, they had the gods of light and the gods of darkness fighting in the great circle, and they had vimanas, and they fought, and they had nuclear devices. That was all, I mean, I don't know how you have a nuclear device be a human trait anyway, but it was there, and these kind of things were reported in the Middle East as well as over in India and China. Mm-hmm. So, you know, look, they're the bad dudes, and they're the ones that are exercising free will with disregard to us or the environment that we're in. This is one of the reasons I think that they broke, because they didn't like having their mind being tied into like a central mind, you know, of God, so that if they wanted to fly their craft from here to there, say, that the central mind could say, you know, the mind of God, would say, look, take a little detour here, because if you go that path, you're going to run into a star or something and break it. I mean, I'm exaggerating it, but basically, if you have a traffic cop guiding free will behavior so that it doesn't step on anybody else's free will, that's mm-hmm. that's what they were rebelling against. They wanted to be free of that entirely and say, look, we'll decide our own, and, you know, devil may pay. I mean, whoever gets in our way, sad. And that's why the rebellion occurred. And apparently a third part of the beings in that level, that parallel universe, and that in the service of the Elohim, they rebelled, and they're being cast down here for one huge great battle. The last one.
Do you base that opinion entirely on things that you have read in the Bible, for instance, in the book of Daniel, in the book of Revelation, in the book of Matthew? Those things are there, but this whole thing about this culminating battle, is that in any other ancient text?
I don't know that I've seen that. I'm just trying to think now. That's an interesting question. I've often wondered about the fact that, you know, heaven, the Christian and Judeo-Christian concept of heaven and concept in many other cultures of that place was a peaceful place, yet there's war in the heavens, according to the Book of the Revelation and other documents in India.
Well, not much that's in actual theology, not much of it has hooks for hanging on to actual reality. There is what the Bible says, and then there is what the theologians say it says. Since I have a degree in that, I will criticize theologians openly and freely, because and then they can say I'm a reprobate, and they can say that I'm a heretic and I'm on my way to hell, and that's okay. If that's the case, there's a theme song for it. AC/DC did it, Highway to Hell. But here's the deal. I can read. And because I can read and I'm not stupid, I have read that book, all 66 of those books. And I've read many, many times those 66 books. So there's not a whole lot that's in theology that comports with the reality of what's actually said in those 66 books. But these 66 books do describe a culminating battle. It also describes a collision with a huge astral body, and by astral, maybe I should say astronomical body. It's called Wormwood. That's the way it's translated. And there's this collision, and it causes a whole lot of death. But it's not a world ender. So there's a lot of that stuff in there. But I'm wondering if there's something in what the Sumerians tell us that lines up with that. Because, you know, they did tell us something that lines up with the biblical story of the flood and Noah. And so I'm wondering if there's something that lines up with these apocalyptic passages. You said you're not aware that they have anything in Sumerian, right?
Not aware of what, sorry?
You're not aware of the Sumerian texts referring to that. Okay, look, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're glad you're here. And in fact, I'm absolutely delighted that you are here. My sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from the first hour. But you're here now, and we're glad of it. My guest this evening is Stan Deo, and we've been talking about real UFOs, flying saucers, anti-gravity craft that he helped to develop. And we've been talking also about the craft and of what he calls super beings. Many of you refer to them as aliens or extraterrestrials. When we went away for break, we were talking about this scenario of a culminating battle between these super beings and which Stan says are the bad guys, and some good guys from their former universe that the universe they formerly were residing in, or the dimension perhaps that they formerly were residing in. And Stan, as we went away for break, I was asking, you know, about the you know, all this stuff, this scenario that you see in biblical text, and then, you know, about a culminating battle, and actually not just a battle, a really gigantic war, a collision with a big rock coming out of space, and all kinds of stuff. So what about in the Sumerian text? Are you aware of any of that being in Sumerian texts?
No, I'm not. That doesn't mean it's not there. I just have not studied as much of the text as some have. The basis of my studying the Sumerian stuff was on the legends of the Tower of Babel and Marduk, who was probably Enki in some of the legends. But I did find a copy of two-thirds of a stela that the Germans had located and stolen during World War II, and it's now been recovered, two-thirds of it anyway, over in, I think it's the Netherlands, in a museum there. And I got photos of it so that I could analyze it, because it was alleged to be a stela that was inscribed in cuneiform and made in the time of the reign of Marduk the Great, which some of the ancient records call the sun god and, you know, the god of lightning powers and whatever. But when I used Photoshop and ran through layers of it to try to lift what was drawn as a blueprint on that stela by Marduk's architect, or by Marduk himself, it revealed a rather interesting thing about the gateway between our world and the parallel universe, the Tower of Babel. Literally, as you know, in the Middle Eastern languages, a bab, a B-A-B, is a doorway. An L is a short form for, you know, God, and it was God doorway, which was the Tower of Bab El. Babel. So I've certainly done a lot of research on that part, but not the prophecies, or what might be the prophecies about a collision hitting us, and that might be talking about the planet the Anunnaki came from, as opposed to them being here. I mean, it seemed to say that there was a world that passes us every so many thousand years, and they jump off to Earth and they jump back before it leaves. But if my calculations of such a planet are correct, it would have to be in our solar system now to coincide with a number of other alleged facts from the Mayan calendars and the dating there. And it would only be in the inner solar system for maybe 11 years tops and then gone. So I'm not sure that we've properly translated the Sumerian records of that, you know, where the Anunnaki came from. What do you think about that?
Well, since I don't read cuneiform and I don't understand Sumerian, I'm at the mercy of people who do read it, and I'm really not in a position to say whether I think it's been translated correctly or not, because I don't read it. I do read Hebrew, and I do know that our English translations of the 66 books that are referred to as the Bible have some very glaring bad translation. In some cases, what it says is so shocking, I think that's why they refuse to translate what's there. That could be a subject for a whole other show. And we might do that sometime, but probably not. Because it's so controversial. But the fact is, there are some very glaringly bad translations. And that's why on the back, when you look at, if you have a Bible and you look at the spine, or you look where it's got the, you know, the name of that translation, it says version. It's the King James Version, the Revised Standard Version. It's not the Bible. It's a version of the Bible, and it's not just a translation. It's the translators give you what they want you to think in many, many cases, and that's easily provable. All right, now.
Well, let me just back up a minute there. You know, if you look at the Hebrew Bible, just the Hebrew Old Testament, you know, a rabbi did some calculations once about trying to explain it in full translation with colloquial values added to the translation and modern terminologies. And he reckoned that it would take 35 times as many pages to explain it in English, you know, the entire Bible properly, and even then would fall short. So you can understand that they were trying to do the abridged version, but I think in the King James Version that there were things that they saw trying to translate that didn't make sense, that didn't relate to the world they knew, and so that, you know, they had a difficulty trying to figure out what word or phrase to use to closely approximate what they thought it said. So I don't think a lot of it was intentional bad translating. It might have been, but I think the majority of the differences in what you and I would read in the Hebrew is due to just ignorance of the things that we now know that they didn't at the time they translated it.
That's true in some cases, but I'll tell you something. I can show you a place where they translated the word wrong 32 times in a row.
Wrong? The actual word wrong, W-R-O-N-G?
No. They wrongly translated from Hebrew to English 32 times in a row the same Hebrew word 32 times in a row. And they knew it because they rightly, correctly translated it later in that same book. And so there are places like that, and but you know, as I say, that would be an interesting other show. But I would have to have the Secret Service. I would have to have the Pope's bodyguards. I would have to have some Navy SEALs around me. for a long time after I did that show.
Kevin, I agree. Okay. I agree. I mean, I know what you're talking about. You and I have talked about it off air, and it would change Christians and Jews' view of the world to really read what is there, and there's a wealth of knowledge and truth there that has not been released to the public.
Oh yeah, it reads better than a Star Wars script.
Oh yeah.
Okay, are you ready to take some telephone calls from the audience?
I am. For just one second, though, I wanted to show you this. Let me just get it here. Okay, this is the what they think the Tower of Babel looked like, and I wanted to show you this, and then the stela that I have been working on for Marduk's time. Up here at the top, you see a level, and then you see flat area around it, and then a stair step coming down to another and another one. According to the legend of this, what happened is the gods would appear from their world at the top here and come out this door and would spend time on this top layer getting their body energy to reduce its intensity so they wouldn't kill somebody by touching them when they came down. And then after a period of time, and there would be snacks and things placed for them here by the locals, and then they would come down to this next level for more delay time to discharge that energy of their bodies because they glowed. And then finally they come down to this level and then finally out. Now, if you look at this is the original stela here. I'll just zoom it up a bit. You can see over here on the right side is Marduk with a cuneiform pen in his hand, a stylus. And over here, you can just see the outline of the front view of the Tower of Babel, and up above that, a plan view of that top floor. Now, I've taken the effort to trace over those so that you can see what he was drawing and what has survived the Germans' damage to it. And you can see here a special little room and that little doorway, just like we saw in the real photograph down there of the what's remained of a ziggurat. And it agrees, except it's got more steps in it than the picture we saw. That's the floor plan there, all separated. I just wanted to show you your listeners that, because these are the kind of things that help you understand more of the truth of our history and relationship with the Creator. That's all. Now we'll go to calls.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or if you have a comment for our guest, Stan Deo, telephone lines are now open, and we have missed 17 calls so far because I just wasn't ready to open the phone line yet, but we've had 17 calls so far.
They were practicing.
We, from you. Yeah, 62, the telephone number, folks, is 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, Kevin, this is Rusty from Michigan.
Hello, Rusty.
Hello. Hello, Stan.
Hello, Rusty.
So, with what you know about these beings, when do you think this attack is coming?
Well, I think that the attack is already underway, and it has been since the early 50s when we had the reports of little grays and tall grays abducting people and doing bad things to them. But I think this is a ruse that the leader of these fallen ones, Satan, has created so that when he appears now with his human-looking, tall, beautiful-type people that are his people, when they appear here, it will not be an invasion so much or an attack as it will be, we're here to help you. We aim to please, and we're going to get rid of those little gray critters and the tall gray ones that have been abducting everybody, and we'll deliver you from that problem. We'll help you with your other problems with food and economy and that kind of stuff. So I think, Rusty, what we're really looking at here is an appearance of evil looking like it's nice. You know, it's a wolf in sheep's clothing. And I think that's going to happen now, you know, the next year or two.
Like to that scripture that says, in the end times, even, I'm going to paraphrase, but it says something on the order of even elect could be deceived.
Absolutely, from Matthew 24, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you think they're the ones that come first are going to be the bad guys? How are we supposed to tell?
Well, first of all, the bad guys have already been manifesting, whether they are robots, biological robots under Satan's control or whatever. We've had 40 or 50 years of alien abductions that nobody will admit to officially, but yet they're here, and lights in the sky and that kind of stuff. Those are the manufactured bad guys. The good guys coming are going to not have the power that the Creator has. As Jesus said in Matthew, if they say to you, the Messiah is here in the desert or in this secret place here, go see him there, that's not me. Because when I come, it will be the lightning from the east to the west. You will know, every living thing will know I am here. You won't have to go to a secret place. I'll be there with you. So that's the difference. And I suspect that those of us who are on board studying Christian prophecy and the Jewish prophecy as well, that we will not be here for that, I suspect. If we are, we will be sequestered by the true God right around us. I think the Holy Spirit will descend, and we will have angels to protect us if we're here. And that's just my opinion based on a number of dream visions that people have been sharing with us in the last year. That's how we tell. I mean, he told you himself how to decipher the real from the fake in Matthew.
All righty. Thanks, Kevin.
All right, Rusty. Thanks for the call. All right, 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. That's the number to call if you're in the USA or Canada. Now, you can call that number from anywhere in the world. However, if you are not in the USA and not in Canada, we understand it can be a little pricey to call that number internationally. So we have another feature, an additional feature for you if you're not in the USA or Canada. It's called a flash message. And so just go to my website, scroll down. You'll see the picture about tonight's show. You'll see Stan Deo's picture there, and by the way, it's linked to his website. But right above that picture, you'll see a link that says Flash Message. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Tony from Denver.
Hello, Tony.
Oh.
Hey, hi. Kevin, thanks for letting us call in the callers tonight and ask questions, and thank you for having your guest back on for another show.
Well, you certainly are welcome, and we need to thank Stan for being willing to come back.
I'm just 2 hours south of Tony. We're here in Pueblo West.
Hey, I have a couple questions for you. Mm-hmm. The earthquakes today, the 2 or 3, depending on how you count, off the coast of Sumatra.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the major earthquake down in Michoacan, Mexico. Mr. Dale, are these earthquakes being caused by Planet X or Wormwood, whatever you want to call it? What do you believe is ahead of us in the next 7 months leading up to December 21st?
Well, I'm not too sure that December 21st is going to be a make-or-break deal in our history, because there's still some discrepancy in the translation of the Mayan calendar. However, the earthquakes that you're talking about, I think, are caused more by the changes in the Earth's diameter, which occurs as a planet ages, it expands. And those earthquakes you mentioned, Holly and I have been watching very closely today, because they're forming a pattern which is leading right up through to Alaska, to the interior of Alaska. And it's a fault line that has, it runs up kind of like this along the west coast. And out in the Pacific, there's a fault line called the Mendocino fault line, which comes into California at the northern part. There's been a quake there. There's been a quake of significance up in the Juan de Fuca plate off of Washington and Oregon, and a number of smaller quakes, a number of them, in interior of Alaska along that same fault line. I do think that we are approaching a time where the rumors or legends or urban legends of California breaking up may be about to start. So that, I think, is a local event caused by local tectonic plate and planetary expansion, not by a planet, because if it were that effective on us, it would be as close as maybe two or three lunar diameters from us, and everyone would see it in the sky. It's too far away to be causing that effect now, if it is there indeed.
Do you believe that the planet X is a brown dwarf sun with orbits planning planets orbiting around it like our sun, or is planet X Nibiru the 12th planet?
Actually, there are orbits for more planets than we've got, and certainly more than 12 if they are filled with something. These orbits can go out nearly 1,000 times the distance of the Earth from the Sun. The planet that they speak about being Planet X would have an orbit, according to the legends, of about 3,600 years. I've done the sums, used the planetary orbital mechanism equations, and found that orbit would have to be, if all the other planets are orbiting around the Sun in a flat plane, ecliptic plane, its orbit would have to be very eccentric, angled like this, and it would travel very slowly out here and very fast as it comes in. There is an orbit that it would be associated with on the ecliptic scale out here at about I think it's 250 astronomical units. It might be 75. I haven't looked at that in a while, but it's way out there. That would be its mean orbit in that plane, but it's tilted maybe 20 to 25 degrees if it is indeed there. It could be, a brown dwarf. I think that there's a lot out there that we don't understand, and unfortunately, when it comes, it may wipe out our technology again, but I'm kind of in a wait-and-see attitude at the moment. And I think if it is there, it would be seen more readily in the southern hemisphere.
Well, Kevin, thanks a lot. I really appreciate this opportunity to call in and ask my questions, and another great show tonight. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, well, you know, if it knocks out our technology and we survive it, you know, I can envision people sitting around a couple of guys sitting there with each with a little stick in his hand, and they're playing tic-tac-toe in the dirt, scratching the game into the dirt. And one guy saying, "Hey, you remember when we used to have internet?" and it's going to be interesting. All right, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hello, Brent.
Hi. Stan... Kevin knows that I do not particularly care for these powers that want to be, whether they're the Illuminati, these transplants from wherever, quote-unquote gods. They're powers that want to be. Now, my experience has been that this is a spiritual journey. I'm just going to ask your opinion of this. What would you say to the possibility of slapping these idiots in a spiritual prison that they cannot escape from until they make spiritual changes within their attitude? But in this prison, they would have all their wits about them, and their only company would be all the pain and suffering they have caused. Now, the reason they would want to change is because if they get out of there, any backsliding, poof, they're gone.
So, would I agree to something like that, do you mean?
Yeah.
Well, that's what God's plan is for them. So, I would agree with that. I think that they will be held in a place of God's judgment. I would think that because God has created life and is not going to take it away from them, that they may be put into a refinement process. God does talk about refining souls like fire refines gold, and so maybe there is going to be that refinement once they're locked up in hell or whatever.
We have to step away for a break. Brent, I want to thank you for the call. Ladies and gentlemen, we will be back shortly. But as we go away, let me remind you, if you have not yet been over to my website and clicked where it says Alternative Universe iConference, get over there and do it. You're running out of time. You need to get your tickets bought before we have to close ticket sales. All right. $10. All right, we will return right after this. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest, Stan Deo. Stan, we have another caller on the line, so all let's right. go straight to the telephone. Caller, your first name and from where are you calling?
How you doing, Stan?
Your first name and from where are you calling?
Rich from Long Island.
Hi, Rich.
Hi, Rich.
We spoke briefly once on L.A. Marzulli talking about some of the work of Nassim Harriman that was up for peer review on tetrahedral mathematics, et cetera. I have a question for you, a little off the beaten path. As far as calendars are concerned, and a little something I've been scratching my head about.
Okay, you're going to have to make it quick.
Maybe you could just, shed a little light on maybe your point of view on this question. We have the Gregorian, the Julian calendar, the Hebrew calendar, et cetera, et cetera. In the time of observing some of the Sabbath. Now,
Rich, you're going to have to make it quick, buddy. You're going to have to get there.
Okay, most people would just say the Sabbath is on a Saturday, but time was kept by the moon back then. How could you just maybe interject a little on that as far as calendars or the observance of anything in the past referencing the Sabbath?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Are you saying the Sabbath might really be on a different day or what?
Well, if time was kept based on the cycles of the moon, wouldn't that make any current calendar irrelevant?
Yes and no. It depends on what system you're using. I guess it really doesn't matter if every seventh day you were doing your Sabbath. It started at some point, and I don't think that they stopped doing it. The 13-month calendar, the Jewish calendar, is based on lunar cycles, and they've kept it as faithfully as they could from their times. Before that, I don't know.
Well, you have two sets of time here. You have a calendar that measures what is considered to be a year, and then you have what is a week. And within a week, there are 7 days. What makes a day? 24 hours. So every seven sets of 24 hours, you've reached the seventh day. Now, how many times do you do that before you've had a year? Well, they use the lunar calendar to determine how long a year was, but it doesn't determine how long a week is.
That's right.
But I think maybe somewhere in the scripture there, you can find the basis of what would be the first day and the seventh day according to the lunar calendar. Would you say I'm correct on that? Or?
I'm not going to say you're incorrect. I will say that I have never seen that.
I haven't either.
There's something I have been wrestling about to, observe one of our most important commandments. And the answer that I feel that the Spirit just keeps ringing in my spirit is, your answer's in the moon. And I just figured I'd throw it out there. Maybe you could shed a little light on that. But okay, appreciate it.
All right, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah. The telephones are open, folks, 623-444-5889, and the Flash message line is open as well, so you can use that to communicate with me if you're outside of the USA or outside of Canada. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Jerome from Pennsylvania.
Hello, Jerome.
Hi. Stan, I want to thank you for coming back on this show. I have a question. You mentioned that you never graduated from the U.S. Air Force Academy. I was wondering why.
Well, that's an interesting story. Basically, I was there for 20 months, and I was my my class, you're divided into four classes, Air Force, third, second, first class. When I was in the fourth class there, I'd gone to the Air Force Academy prep school the year before at the academy. And I was elected by my classmates at the academy to be the honor code representative for our squadron, the 22nd Squadron. Part of that was to sit in judgment of fellow cadets who broke the honor code of lying, cheating, or stealing. And if they did that, it was up to us as judges, in essence, of our fellow classmates, to say whether they could stay at the academy or whether they get booted out, gone. During the time I was there, there was some candy being taken out of what we call the boodle room in our squadron area, which you could sign up on a piece of paper as you walk out the door, day or night, get, you know, a candy bar, and then by Thursday when your paycheck came in, you would pay for what you'd taken, and even if you didn't write it down, you would come back and write it down and pay the bill, which, you know, everybody cooperated with, except somebody was stealing candy, and we didn't know who. The regular Air Force officers at the base used cameras and sat outside the windows on the parapet there looking in, and filmed everybody going in after hours, you know, during the night when you're supposed to be asleep. One of the guys they filmed from our squadron was a Negro, a friend of mine. His name is not important here, but he was a very good cadet, and they said that he had taken candy out, say on a Monday, I think it was, and had walked across the threshold and back to his room without marking it up. They did admit that he came back on Thursday and marked it up and paid for it. So they brought him in to us to judge to see whether he'd violated the honor code. And we said, well, no. And the regular Air Force officer, wait a minute. Did you go through that doorway, cadet? He's talking to the fellow. He said, and as you went through it, did the thought occur to you that you didn't have to mark it up, that nobody would know? And the cadet said, well, I don't know. I guess it could have. Then you're guilty of an honor code violation, and you're summarily dismissed from the academy. Wow. Well, we protested, and they did the same kind of nonsense with another guy that was of German extraction there, shorter than most, and probably wouldn't make what they consider to be good officer material because of it, and he was a good guy. And this happened throughout the cadet wing that year, and in over a period of several weeks. They were culling out what they didn't want to be in the officer corps, and the black fellow was, they didn't want any black officers. So I protested, and a lot of us did. Over 150 of us protested in the, you know, the Honor Code Society, and we refused to take our final exams that year and said, look, we're going to go on strike until you set this right. You can't kick these men out on trumped-up charges. They did not violate the Honor Code. And they said, no, if you do that, we'll confine you to your quarters and, over Christmas holiday, and then you will be gone. So we all, to a man, stood true, and were under, you know, room arrest except to go to meals and come back. And at night, between about 12 and 2 or 3 in the morning, they would come and take one of us off to the checkout, you know, to the admin office, and put us on a taxi up to Denver and to a plane home. And my time finally came, and I was gone. I stood by my guns then, and I stand by them now. It was unfair, and so on a point of honor, I didn't finish.
That's a pretty interesting story. Also, on this hollow coil that powered this flying saucers, you said there was a new metal?
MU, M-U. It's a superconductive.
Okay. Yeah. I just thought you said new.
Okay.
On this coil, it had the archways. Could a person actually walk around inside there if they were short enough? I mean,
yeah, you could walk around inside the craft in the circle that you saw, something similar to that. There was an area up above that, a cockpit area, and they had to shield that for the time effects if they wanted to run at a different time than the craft itself. But it's kind of like a dome that fit down over the top of that, and that's where the main crew activity occurred. But you could get down into that area to service parts.
And did they have to add an outside power source to this, or was it just the shape and the material that
no.
it made this?
No, they had their own power source. There are a number of ways that they were doing it. In the beginning, they used, before that, they had what they called a plasma craft, which shot ionized charged air over the surface of the top of the craft and down underneath and back into a recharging chamber, a direct current high voltage, and that was moving air. When they graduated from that to true anti-gravity, they had developed a couple of things about the size of a small home air conditioner that would take energy out of atoms in a coherent or ordered fashion so that they could convert heat into electricity by impacting a particular metal target with a frequency of radiation. There were other ways to get energy out of the environment, but that was usually in static form outside of a craft in a stable position on the Earth. There were also ways to store energy in high spin rate plasmas contained within a sphere. They weren't quite as good as they wanted, because if you cracked one of them, it would vaporize a large portion of the craft when it broke. But in essence, what it was doing was spinning a small amount of gas at an extremely high rate inside of a containment field. And it was, in essence, a flywheel of charged gas spinning at 32 million times a second or so.
Well, thank you, Stan, and thank you, Kevin.
You're certainly welcome. Thanks for the call. 623-444-5889. If you have a question or a comment for Stan, that's the number to call. I noticed over here on the flash message board, what happens if you send me a flash message and you're in the USA or Canada? It flashes up there, and I take a look at it. It's funny we call it flash message, because I get a little flashing notice on my screen, okay? And I take a look at it, and what it does is it says flash message, incoming flash, deleted. Well, I took a look, and I don't see the message. It just shows me where it came from. So I have had a couple that came in from the USA or Canada. If you're in the USA or you're in Canada, the only way for you to communicate with us is telephone. And the flash message is there. That feature is there because we know it's expensive for people outside the USA or Canada to make an international telephone call. So that's why we provide that flash message feature. So give us a call, 623-444-5889. Stan, have you ever been on board one of these craft?
No, I wish I had been, but no, I didn't get on board.
You ever seen one up close and personal?
No.
Now, what specifically were you working on with these craft? Were you working on the propulsion system?
Yes. I was recruited because I was about to patent or apply for patent here in the States for a dynamic plasma craft. Basically, it was a saucer shape, and the core of that craft was going to generate a high temperature charged environment to charge air, shoot it out up through a cupola on the top and out over the wing and back underneath, to form this kind of breaststroking torus of charged air, which would come back in, be recharged, and come back out. And that was what I was doing as a charged plasma craft. Well, I didn't know they'd already been there and done that in the early 60s. But they recruited me to see what else I could contribute to the project based on what I had been doing. And,
okay. We're going to pick up there when we come back. We have to step away for break. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, we'll be on Final Approach. Get your fingers ready. If you want a call, we'll have time for one call, maybe two. We'll be back. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And to my guest this evening, Stan Deo. Would you believe, Stan, even after I made that announcement and explanation about the flash messages and how I don't even see the ones that come from Canada and from the USA, I just get a notice that it came in, but it gets automatically deleted. I don't even see the message. Made the announcement, got a flash message deleted from the USA. 623-444-5889 is the telephone number. And let me say this, we've had 41 unique callers tonight. But only five of you so far have gotten through. Now, what happens is a whole bunch of people try to call at the same time, and so you all get that message. So just keep hitting redial and keep trying. You'll get through, okay? Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's John from Vancouver Island.
Hello, John.
Hi, Stan.
Hi, John.
Hi. You were talking about these super beings that were the fallen ones.
Right.
Right. And also, we humans are in a fallen state.
Right.
Yeah, so what I was wondering about is you got the one group that are fallen that are still quite powerful, and you got the human group that are fallen that are kind of like sitting ducks. So I'm wondering what's up with that.
Well, what do you mean by what's up with it, John? I don't understand.
Well, you got two fallen groups. One's really powerful, the other's really weak.
Right.
And it seems to me like it's a uneven distribution of powers that go along with being in a fallen state.
Well, yeah, but they're fallen from a higher position than we were. I mean, they were in the parallel dimension as citizens with knowledge and technology way beyond what we can even imagine at the moment. When they were fallen from a much higher height, if you wish, in technology and knowledge than we were from the Garden of Eden time. We are protected as long as we sign on with the Lord, our Messiah, Yeshua. And we're protected. We're not that weak. I guess that's the best way I can answer that, John.
John, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Where do you get the information that we're fallen, and what does that mean?
We're fallen from a previous state of, I don't know what you would call it, a higher state, I guess. And I get that from the Bible, from the Garden of Eden story.
Well, if Adam fell, he fell up the stairs. And he did not get kicked out of the garden because he sinned. That isn't what caused him to be kicked out of the garden. Because in Genesis, the Lord God, whoever that may be, is quoted as stating the precise charge, if you want to call it that, against Adam as to why he had to be kicked out of the garden. And the precise charge was, now the man has become one of us. He had been elevated from being just a biological entity to being Elohim. Psalm 82, the boss God.
I'll look that up, okay, Kevin. That's really interesting.
The boss God. Well, he specifically says that. Now the man has become one of us, lest he reach forth his hand and take of the fruit of the tree of life. He must go forth from the garden. Okay, the tree of life is throughout Middle Eastern cultures is a metaphor for what we call DNA. Now, in Psalm 82, the boss God stands in the congregation of the gods, although your English translation says he stands in the congregation of the mighty. That is not what Hebrew says. In Hebrew, Yahweh Elohim stands in the congregation of the Elohim, and he says about us, have I not said you are all Elohim? But you'll die like men. See, the problem here is everybody's running around this planet thinking they're human. You're not human. You're Elohim. If that information in the Bible is accurate, and that's a whole different discussion. But if that's where we're going to get our information about who we are and what our status is, well, let's get it out of the words that are actually published instead of what the theologians have written.
So what I'm hearing you say, Kevin, is we're Elohim right here, right now.
No, that's not what I'm saying. That's what Genesis says. That's what Psalm says. That's what Jesus said in the book of John whenever he was about to get stoned to death. And he said, hang on, guys. I've done a lot of good works here in my Father's name. For which of these do you wish to kill me? And they said, well, it's not because of that. It's because you say you are the son of Elohim. And he said, he quoted Psalm 82. He said, well, your own scripture says, have I not said you are all Elohim?
That's true.
So if you guys are Elohim, what's your problem with me saying I'm the son of Elohim? So, no, I'm not claiming that we're Elohim. I am saying that that is what is claimed all through these books that are called the Bible, 66 books. And all those ancient texts make references to things about us being not human. But specifically in these that I've quoted, it specifically states what race we are. Now,
well,
you know, it's the question is, do you want to believe what's there or not? That's a whole different discussion.
Yeah. Okay. Where does the idea of fallen humans come from then?
That's a whole different discussion. It has nothing to do with the Garden of Eden. It has to do with, if you are Elohim and you're running around this planet thinking you're human and you're acting like a human instead of like an Elohim, would you say you're fallen?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what that has to do with. So everybody on this planet that thinks they're human are fallen.
Okay. So let's say we got tricked into thinking we're human and not Elohim.
Mm-hmm.
Then the job would be, or the priority would be, let's get back to the place before we thought we were only human.
That is true, and I wish we had more time. John, we're out of time. But yeah, you're right. But see, this whole discussion is why I say the problem with Earth is kangaroos. You got a whole planet full of population running around thinking, I'm a kangaroo. They hop like kangaroos. They eat nuts and berries like kangaroos. But they're not kangaroos, and they never can be a kangaroo, but they believe they are. Same thing with trying to be human. There were humans on this planet at one time. They're not here anymore. Okay? They're gone. There was a little problem they called the flood, kind of wiped out the human population, and all that was left was Noah and his family, and they were pure blood Elohim. So there you go. Now, do you want to believe all of that scenario? It's all published there in the Bible, and it's all, you can see it even in English, but it's published there, and it's been there all this time for your eyes to read. Now the question is, have you read it? And then once you read it, do you buy the story? I mean, that's a whole other discussion.
And let me just point out too, Kevin, that
5 seconds
after the flood, the giants were here on the earth, and that's a very hard thing to explain because they crossbred with us, and that might have polluted the
gene. Yeah, wish we had more time. Boy, that opened up a whole can of other stuff to talk about.
Yeah,
we'll have you back, but. And I hope you'll come back. Stay on the line with me for just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's a wrap for this evening. Oh, boy, will my inbox be aflame now. All right. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.